So we move into the labyrinth now, as we start talking about matriarchal consciousness. And the readings that I've given you are, on the one hand, Edward Whitmont's and, on the other hand, Robert Bly. Now, I haven't done this arbitrarily. Whitmont, who's written this chapter, Consciousness and Evolution, is an intellectual. He's open-minded about all this stuff, but he's an intellectual. He's actually a representative of what he himself would call mental phase culture. Mental phase versus magical, mythical. Right, okay. Mental phase culture. He's written a very analytic, intellectual book which probes earlier levels of consciousness. But he himself, even though he's a psychiatrist and is very good at interpreting myth and dream and whatnot, is a very strongly intellectual type of person. So to balance that out, we have another book, which is written by a poet, right? Who is somebody who lives at the level of symbolic life, because he's a poet. And that's Robert Bly. Now, Robert Bly might be considered, if you know about Bly, sort of an unusual person to be reading when we're talking about matriarchal consciousness, because he was the big hero of the men's movement starting in the 1980s. And a lot of feminists really disliked him. But Bly was much more complex than that. And there he has this article that he's written in the middle of one of his books, Sleepers Joining Hands, okay, which is called I Came Out of the Mother Naked. And it references a poem. Well, anyhow, I'm not going to get into that right now. So, what do we have? We have an approach to the problem of reintegrating the different levels of consciousness that have been evolving from the point of view of mental and from the point of view of mythic or poetic. So something's missing, and what's missing is understanding this reintegration from the point of view of the body. Magical. Okay. Now, we can't really, through literature, address the problem because it's pre-verbal. Remember that? So in the early 20th century, I've said this before, the great founder of modern dance, Isadora Duncan, when she was asked, what do her dances mean, said, if I could explain it, I wouldn't dance it. Right? So we're going to end this session by looking at some dance. So I'm going to introduce something about the relationship between Bly and Whitmont, but then I'm going to jump to a very interesting phenomenon. And then we'll come back to more detail about Bly and Whitmont. But today, what I want to talk about, interestingly, is not Whitmont, but Bly. And to give you an idea of the distinction between the way Bly thinks about things as a poet, which is to say mythic mind, associationist thinking, and the way Whitmont thinks about the same problems, which is mental level of mind, analytic thinking, listen to these two passages. I think what I'm going to do actually is I'm going to read Whitmont first. This is on page 59 when he's talking about the mythological or imaginal phase. So bear with me while I read this. But this is to understand the tone of analysis of these two approaches. The discovery of two-ness means the splitting of the original undifferentiated one, not only into man and world, but also into female and male. But as consciousness evolves further into the androlatic, that means male, frame of reference, the one unitary reality is increasingly fragmented into a multiplicity of mutually exclusive opposites, good, evil, subject, object, etc. This tendency toward awareness by means of splitting is inherent in the masculine character, which gains increasing importance. The divisive and eventually analytic character of patriarchal consciousness is of male character. This particular way of experiencing is obviously only one among others. That's key. This particular way of experiencing is obviously only one among others. But he's actually speaking about himself here, but that's okay. It is not a necessary or intrinsic quality of consciousness as such. Used as we are to the patriarchal ways, it has come to appear the only possible way to us. However, a more yin tone consciousness, that means a more feminist tone consciousness, to use a Chinese expression, which is beginning to emerge again in our own time, does not operate in divisive separation, but through intuitive perception of whole processes and inclusive patterns. This is the predominant function of the right half of the cerebral cortex. Well, he was probably wrong about that last part, because physiological psychology has progressed a little bit beyond that. Now listen to Bly talking about something very similar. Poetic way of thinking about things. Associationist logic, talking about something very similar, though. When masculine consciousness, this is from the essay, I Came Out of the Mother Naked, page 32. When masculine consciousness became aware of itself, it took for its main image the bright blue sky surrounding the sun. Its metal then was gold. Apollo had gold sun rays around his head. The right hand became favored over the left, mountaintops over valleys, 1 and 3 over 2 and 4, the square over the circle. It creates straight roads. Now here's something really interesting. Matriarchies are interested primarily in what is inside walls, that is to say the womb, what's inside. But the patriarchies become aware of the space between walls. Now here's associationist thinking for you. Empires grow from patriarchies, because empires are interested in the space between, or imperial expansion is about the space between walled cities, the conquest of the space around walled cities. That was the imperial expansion. Patriarchs plot out the ground in huge squares. In thinking, Socrates sounds the note. Avoid myths, which are always stories of the mother anyway, and think logically, in a straight line. Remember, I started this class by saying, we're in the labyrinth. We're not going to go in any straight lines for a while. Patriarchies develop the thinking power of the newest part of the brain, the neocortex. The great mother may be considered the goddess of the cortex or mammal brain. The mother goddess of Crete, mother goddesses of Crete were always sculpted with their breasts bare, as if to say, I have breasts, therefore I am. What did, I think therefore I am? Right? Isn't this different? Well, of course, that's what Bly intended. Father consciousness tries to control mammal nature through rules, morality, commandments, and tries to reach the spirit through asceticism. And he goes on and on this way. This should give you an idea of the distinction between different ways of thinking, which I'm wanting to emphasize here. And we're going to see a third, we're going to see and hear a third way of thinking in a moment. Now, Bly goes on to do something else, which is sort of my introduction to where we're going here. Bly talks about, in this essay, the four faces of the mother. He really means four aspects of femininity. But he likes to talk about the mother because he's talking about the mother goddess. Okay. Now, when he talks about the four faces of the mother, the way he does this is he says, we've got the great mother that we're familiar with as the great goddess from whom all life comes forth. But he said, in every beginning there's an end. So now we're getting some ideas about what this Dionysus thing is about, by the way. For every beginning there's an end. So there has to be an energy which ends what the great mother has given birth to. And he calls that energy the death goddess, Kali in India. So the female gives birth, but by giving birth to us, we all suffer the sentence of death. Our mothers are responsible for our deaths. If you think about it, it's true. If we weren't given birth, we would never die. Right? So that which the female brings into the world, the female takes back. Or in the English language, sometimes the shorthand is womb, tomb. This is the basic line of existence. Bly points out that it was Neumann who recognized that there was something else going on in the ancient world, which is really interesting. Some people are aware of this. Almost no one's aware of this. So there's another line. Said, there's an ecstatic mother, which is usually shown as dancing. And whereas the great mother is usually portrayed in her 30s, like in Greek images, the dancing mother is younger. She's in her 20s. She's usually seen as virginal, not because she's a virgin, but because she doesn't give birth to children. She's responsible for a different kind of life. It's not physical life, it's spiritual life. But just as the great mother gives birth to physical life, and the death mother is responsible for the end of physical life, there is a female aspect that ends the work of the dancing mother, the ecstatic mother, and that's the stone mother or tooth mother. And the end of ecstatic life or creative life is mental dismemberment, being stoned, being dried up. And all the great artists of the world were always in danger of sliding from this to this, according to Bly. Who should know? This is a very interesting phenomenon. Now, let me jump to something that Bly doesn't say. Whitman emphasizes, when he talks about Dionysus, Whitman emphasizes the way in which Dionysian mentality or Dionysian consciousness is associated with aggression and death. But in the ancient world, Dionysus was also the god of intoxication. He became Bacchus in later myth, the god of wine or intoxication. Intoxication is ecstasy. Intoxication is the ecstatic state. You talk to really seriously creative artists, they're ecstatic in the process of creation. Ecstasy literally means, in Greek, out of the body. They're hardly in their bodies when they're creating, in many cases, anyway. Okay. It seems to me, this is a hypothesis, it seems to me that Whitmont, because of his personal history, emphasizes the aggressive, violent aspect of Dionysus and Dionysian mentality. Bly does not. He emphasizes the ecstatic side, and he looks at it more from the female point of view. But in fact, in the ancient Greek stories, if men accidentally were to join in the women's worship of Dionysus, they ran the risk of being dismembered, because the Dionysian revels were at a level of consciousness which was both ecstatic and dangerous in the sense of it dismembered men. Now, this might be symbolic, because the dancing mother, who is the other side of the Dionysian consciousness, remember we're into analogic thinking here, this isn't logical. The Dionysian and the dancing mother, the dancing female, there is the danger of dismemberment in the creative process, especially if it's overemphasized. Artists burn themselves out. Artists are torn apart mentally. So now I'm going to give you an example of this. And we'll come back to this later. The example is a ballet, of all things. Let's warm this up. In 1913, in Paris, three Russian geniuses staged a ballet called The Rite of Spring. Okay. Stravinsky was responsible for the music. Nijinsky was responsible for the choreography. Rorick was responsible for the set design and the costumes. We're going to see some of this in a minute. Recreated by the Joffrey Ballet in 1987. I have a particular affinity for this because as a college student, I was lucky enough to be able to hear Stravinsky conduct the Rite of Spring in Los Angeles. And then I was really lucky that I was living in San Francisco in 1987 when the Joffrey Ballet came through and they restaged the original ballet as best they could recreate it. Blew me away. Now, what happened? Rorick was an archaeologist, among other things, and he had been excavating, along with some other people, early Slavic culture. These people got very interested in their roots as Russians, and they were trying to reintegrate with their roots as they created this ballet. So this is the theme, reintegration, right? Completeness, the Jungian goal, reintegration. So this is, in a certain sense, what they're attempting to do. Whether or not they were successful, very interesting. If you look at the lives of these three, of course, there's the Russian Revolution, which creates some complications in looking at the lives of these three. Stravinsky, the musician, goes on to be world famous, lives to a ripe old age with all kinds of acclaim. Great composer, okay. Rorick, the set designer and archaeologist, goes to Tibet and takes up meditation. Nijinsky, the brilliant dancer, goes crazy, ends his life in a mental institution. This is what happens to these three geniuses who are engaged in this path. Very, very different things happen to them. I don't consider this arbitrary. I don't consider this arbitrary at all. So this is from the original set from Nijinsky, not Nijinsky. This is Rorick's original set design. This is one of the backdrops for the Rite of Spring, this tree. So I just show it to you for interest's sake. And here, the Joffrey Ballet staging the Rite of Spring on YouTube. And I'm just going to do a couple of extracts to get an idea of what's going on here. We're not going to watch the whole thing. You might want to. It's an amazing piece of work. In 1913,